All right, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today is February 7th, and I always have to check just to make sure I've got the date right. And so we are, the first order of business is to approve the minutes from February 2nd, our last meeting. Is there anyone who would care to make a motion to approve the minutes?
Madam Chair, so moved.
All right, thank you. Representative Hewitt moves approval of the minutes of February 2nd. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, if you would unmute yourselves for just a moment. All in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you, members. So today we are going to hear some presentations of the governor's supplemental budget. We're going to start out with DHS. And we have some slides here for you. And we have a number of presenters from DHS. We're going to try to cover this in about 35 minutes, so we may be moving through fairly quickly. I do want to give members an opportunity to ask questions, but I assume that all of our presenters can at least stay on until we get through the DHS presentation. So what I would ask you all to do that, and let's hold our questions until we get through the first presentation. And then we'll do the same with the other presentations that we have. So after we have DHS, we also have the MNSHR budget. And then we have a presentation on family home visiting, which is a very big feature of the governor's supplemental budget. So let's start out then with Commissioner Harpstead. I haven't seen you yet, but I see you're here.
Madam Chair, do we have to take attendance?
Oh, Representative Hewitt, thank you very much. I completely forgot that. Yes, we certainly do. All right, sorry about that. Ms. Niedernhofer, please take the roll.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher. Ackland.
Ackland, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damuth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grinhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson. Pryor. Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer, and thank you again, Representative Hewitt. I am obviously out of practice for doing this regular procedure. I'll have to underline that on my script here. Okay, very good. Well, thank you, Representative Harpstead. The floor is yours.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. Let's get our slide deck going here. There we go. So grounded in their vision for One Minnesota, Governor Walz's and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's proposed budget to move Minnesota forward is a balance of key investments in four main categories: local jobs and projects, expanding economic opportunity, supporting kids and families, and protecting public safety. DHS proposals cross all four areas with many important investments. I would like to call out three that are critical to us. Workforce shortages in the caring professions have deepened during the pandemic and pose a threat to health, independence, and stability of Minnesotans who rely on these services. The investment of $115 million will help bolster worker retention by establishing a fund for worker incentive payments, tuition reimbursements, and childcare grants. Investing in our human services infrastructure includes the continuation of our service delivery transformation project. Investing $77.5 million to support IT systems will help us create a person-centered experience to transform modernization and integrate service delivery. This includes IT work on the MN benefits application to allow expansion to additional programs and investments to strengthen the state's existing IT infrastructure with new support vendor-supported systems. And third, supporting additional investments in continuous improvement and compliance expansion to complete the major investments in process improvements we began after overpayments were discovered in 2019, and to keep up with the tsunami of grant rep RFPs and contracts that come out of surplus budget sessions. Next slide. This is the supplemental budget package as it affects the Department of Human Services. You can see at the bottom that it's $484.6 million for the first biennium and $1.7 billion for the second. And you can see the breakout here of the various funds that are affected. The governor's supplemental budget includes proposals that address the challenges we face today while investing in the future to ensure we emerge from this time of crisis stronger than before. The DHS budget is a mix of new investments in priority areas that you can see here on the screen, as well as funding to make sure basic services such as our direct care and treatment programs have the support they need. Next slide. Moving into specific proposals, I will cover the first one, our Caring Professions Workforce Program. The governor recommends revitalizing the state's behavioral health, direct support, housing, and home care services by establishing a workforce incentive fund. This fund could be used to offer additional compensation, including but not limited to retention payments, hiring bonuses, and financial assistance for post-secondary education. Employers in these industries would be allowed to apply for grants to deliver these incentives to employees who've been employed for 6 months or longer for $115 million. Next slide and next presenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, excuse me. This is Jeff Johnson, Deputy Commissioner for Operations for the Department of Human Services.
Welcome.
I'm going to share with you some slides. Thank you, Madam Chair. The first slide, Commissioner Harps had mentioned, service delivery transformation continuation. This is a proposal to move Minnesota toward a person-centered integrated human services delivery system. This proposal builds on work we started 5 years ago in partnership with counties and tribes to develop a vision for the future of human services. 2019, you provided us with funding and support, and we said we would come back with a plan, and this is that plan. The focus of this plan is squarely on the consumer, the people and families served by human services in Minnesota, improving the consumer experience, improving their access to services, improving coordination of service and connection between services so people get all the services they need to meet their needs in a more holistic way for individuals and families, as well as giving the opportunity for people to have more control over their services and over their own data. The foundation of this proposal is a set of recommendations from Gartner Consulting, who we contracted with, for a roadmap to help Minnesota achieve this vision. This roadmap is fully aligned in its approach with the recommendations of the Blue Ribbon Council on Information Technology, specifically the modernization playbook that that group developed, using human-centered design, moving toward a product agile approach in how we do our work, and building, really understanding the success depends on building a foundation of the business and IT capabilities in order to do this scale of modernization, understanding and working with counties and tribal partners, understanding their needs, developing the capacity for procurement and vendor management and so forth. As Commissioner Harp said, we have an example of what success looks like when we do it this way, and that's MN Benefits, the tool we launched statewide last fall, provides a portal for application for 9 cash, child care, and food programs. MN Benefits reduces the application time from over 60 minutes to about 12 minutes. It's mobile enabled, simple to use, has a Spanish version available. It was developed in line with all the principles I just talked about, an iterative design with consultation frequently with county and tribal partners at the front lines, as well as with consumers, getting their feedback as we designed the app and made the changes on what would work better for them. Consistent with where we started with MN Benefits and with the Gartner recommendation, our first focus would be on eligibility and enrollment, and that's the function that really touches almost everybody in the human services system, highly technology dependent and full of pain points for our county tribal partners, as well as for consumers. In addition to the Gartner roadmap, this will also, as Commissioner Harps said, include further enhancements for MN Benefit, support organizational change, we need to move to a product agile approach. Cloud computing technology support, which is necessary to achieve this vision. We're also focusing on broader needs within our system. That includes strategic investment to sustain our legacy systems. We understand that these systems will be with us for a while, need to continue to maintain them, and also ongoing support for various other areas where we have had some gaps within our IT infrastructure funding, including ongoing maintenance and operations of existing solutions. I know that this will be thought of as a big IT proposal, but I hope as we go forward, we also see it as an opportunity to transform how we deliver services to the people of Minnesota. In relationship to IT, the next slide focuses on our need within direct care and treatment for an electronic health record. This is really a proposal to implement a fully compliant and fully functional electronic health record system for direct care and treatment. For compliance, for improved efficiency, to improve and support safe, high quality care, as well as monitoring equity outcomes and enhancing the continuum of care. In 2008, the Department of Health mandated that all health systems and health facilities have electronic health records, and DCT has not met this timeline, which was supposed to be in place by 2015. We've been using operational funds in direct care and treatment to start development of an electronic medical record over the last couple of years. We need this funding to accelerate and complete the development. Lack of a fully functional electronic health record significantly impacts DCT's efficiency and ability to provide quality care and treatment to patients and clients. Right now, we have 300,000 filing inches of paper medical records for over 100,000 patients and clients. To get a complete understanding of any of the patients or clients we're serving requires often going back and forth between electronic and medical records. This is really burdensome and creates potential errors or miss opportunities for things that are hard to find in the records that we have. It's also really hard to move records when someone moves between our services, about 200 different sites that we run, much less when we're coordinating with external service providers or moving a patient on. We have no ability to track routine health maintenance issues like vaccines. We rely on ad hoc things like spreadsheets and other ways of doing that. This current system is paradoxically duplicative and incomplete at the same time. This proposal will complete the electronic health record in two phases. Phase one would implement an electronic medical record across DCT. That's the first step in replacing our paper files and allowing tracking of care over time. And also, we need to have that in place in order to go to the second phase, which is a fully integrated electronic health record. And that allows the whole person care and coordination, both within our own system and across external systems. Next proposal the governor has in human services, a continuous improvement to compliance expansion. Commissioner Harpstead mentioned this as well. This proposal enhances DHS's ongoing effort to improve agency compliance and process controls. In 2019, when payment issues arose, Commissioner Harpstead took immediate steps to address the issues that were identified, but we also took steps to prevent such issues from occurring in the future to further enhance and develop our agency compliance tools. We fully implemented compliance structure and reporting across the agency, focusing on mitigating known risks. We also asked our Office of Continuous Improvement to implement Operation Swiss Watch to directly address Medicaid payment issues and management of grant contracts, the biggest issues that have been identified in audits. This proposal that you have in front of you will help to strengthen our compliance process by addressing some critical staffing need areas, as well as expanding our capacity to examine and improve process controls going forward. Specifically, we're asking for 10 FTEs in our contract legal compliance division. This is the division that manages all the contracts that come through our agency. As Commissioner Harpstead said, this has been a growing volume over time, particularly in the grant contract area. 6 FTEs here are really devoted to just dealing with the process and the scope of contracts that we have. We're using a lot of overtime right now with this division to keep up with the work. 4 of the FTEs, though, would really get us put into a better position for agency-wide contract compliance monitoring function. So we're really centrally monitoring our compliance, and this includes a database for monitoring contract compliance as well. We also like to add 2 auditors to our internal audits division, keep our focus on risk-based analysis, the program payments and rate setting and billing practices. And then finally, this includes 7 additional continuous improvement staff. These are the black and green belts. These are the people that really help us with our process controls and our process, business process design, and a very valuable tool for us over time. What we'd really like to do is have more resources be able to put into examining all of our business processes to be able to identify not just where we can be more efficient, but also where we can be more aligned with compliance and identify where the gaps and risks are that we may need help mitigating. In addition, on this slide, I just wanted to note there's another proposal which is supporting drug price litigation costs. Attorney General Ellison has joined several lawsuits against drug manufacturers that are conspiring to illegally fix prices in the drug markets. We're not party to the lawsuit, but we were issued a subpoena with extensive discovery requests. As a result, we are going to have to contract with an external party to help us manage the volume that we need for this discovery request, and the governor recommends $228,000 to help mitigate that cost. And Madam Chair, with that, I will hand it to Inspector General Kalani Moti.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. We appreciate your presentation. And Ms. Moti, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kalani Moti. I'm the Inspector General here at DHS and members of the committee. I'm going to be here speaking on two of our slides. The first one is the governor's recommending providing funding for critical resources in our licensing division. And this would be specifically to address the growth in the number of foster care and home and community-based licensed services and applications and providers that we're seeing in this area. These staff will also address the growth in work related to maltreatment investigations, which have doubled over the last 6 years. By providing this additional staff, we will decrease the number of times it takes to conduct home and community-based services licensing visits, processing the applications, increase the timeliness of foster care reviews, and support the agency in meeting our statutory timelines and obligations in reviewing and investigating maltreatment complaints. Next slide. This slide is related to our transition from emergency background studies to our fully compliant background studies, and we're requesting one-time funding, which is similar to what the allocation was last year, to cover the costs of people who had submitted emergency studies. During the peacetime emergency following, during the peacetime emergency, the department waived or modified several state background studies requirements, and we request additional funding to credit the remaining 165,000 emergency studies. And this is, again, relates to our phased-in transition on this, and there were more studies that were submitted. There was a longer time for which we were in the emergency study phase of it, and so we would need additional funding in order to give that credit back. And with that, I'm going to be passing it off to the next presenter.
All right. Before we go to Ms. Matemba Mutasa, I think we're doing really well on time. So I think we could pause here. And if members do have any questions, I know this is a lot of information. We have sent out the slides, and for the public, the slides are posted on our website as well, I believe, or they will be. For you to look at this at your leisure, but Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is on the FTEs, the 43. Are these ongoing, or are they being hired just for a short period of time? I forget the name of the person who made that presentation, yeah. And I have one other.
Okay, I think it might be Mr. Johnson or even the commissioner. And I think this had to do with there were two slides that had significant numbers of FTEs, and they were both technology projects. Mr. Johnson, was that one of yours?
Madam Chair, it appears that the 43 is actually on the licensing slide that Inspector Dharmoti addressed.
Was that the one you wanted to ask about? Representative Grunhagen?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, Ms. Moti.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. These would be for ongoing positions, new positions that we would need to add. One thing to note is since the inception of the home and community-based licensed services that came in January of 2014, we've increased the number of services that we actually license for. They've gone from 19 to 31. We've added a lot more service lines, more providers are adding in that, and our licensor number hasn't increased. And so we have more coming in than what we are actually able to handle and to regulate. And so we would need to be adding in additional permanent staff in order to handle that growth.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for that response. And then the other question is on the IT information. I think the first individual made that presentation. And, you know, when I think of government and IT, it doesn't mesh very well, especially with the debacle we had with the driver's license situation. I think we wasted $100 million and we had to go back, something like that, and then go back and redo it again. I'm just wondering if the RFPs are going to be for a private company to do this, if he knows at this time, or are we going to do it in-house, or what's the plan if he knows at this point?
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, it's likely to be a large amount of the work is likely to be externally contracted with private vendors, but it depends a little bit on the particular project that we get into. I think one of the things that we are trying to get away from is doing the very large project, like the MNLARS project that you referenced, and the Blue Ribbon Commission that I sat on, as did Representative Bonner, examined that project really closely, and the recommendations we made as part of the modernization playbook were really to address how to do these large-scale modernizations in a way that minimizes that risk and doesn't create that point where you have a great big system built, you spent all that money and you flip the switch and it doesn't work right. And a lot of that is the work that has to be done ahead of time to really document and understand your business processes and understand how to make those processes, how to automate those processes so they really work for the people who need to work it, whether in our case it's the counties and also the consumers who we serve. So we're trying to move toward a product agile approach, which is really a more iterative development where you make small changes and build on those changes with constant improvement rather than having that big flip to switch after 3 years of development kind of experience. In the case of the MN benefits that I mentioned that we launched last fall, there were 51 releases done last year. So basically every week they were releasing something new, just tweaking, just trying to make it better based on the feedback that we were getting from the county workers, from the tribal workers, and most importantly from consumers. So that's a long-winded answer, but I think, yes, we'll be contracting for much of this work.
Okay, I think we have three more members who want to ask a question, and then we'll move on to the rest of the presentation. Representative Ryer, then Bonner, then Damon. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and my question is for Mr. Johnson. Thank you so much for your presentation. Two things. One is, as a person who's led large technology projects, I'm very grateful that you are using a human-centered design and a agile methodology. It's a much stronger approach to getting us where we need to be, having, more modern and user-friendly interfaces. My question is about business processes and where you are in terms of identifying specific processes that need to be improved, especially those that could be streamlined and optimized without a major technology investment, because we can get a lot of return just by changing processes, and it doesn't require necessarily the big dollar sign. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair and Representative Ryer, we're at the beginning, I think, when you look at the broader human services system. I think internally as a department, we're doing a pretty good job of working on our business processes. But as I mentioned in one of the other budget pages, we are wanting to do more of that work. I think the example of benefits, again, selecting a particular pain point in the system, applying, and people spending an hour battling with what was really not very functional online application versus being able to do it in 12 minutes. And looking where those pain points are is the word that has been shared with me often is, you know, renewal is another process and trying to figure out where are these processes that just don't work very well for people and how can we digitize that process to make it more effective and more efficient. And so we're starting into that work, but we're not very far into it yet, I wouldn't say.
Okay. Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that. And for those of you on this call who are not IT related, just to throw this out there, thank you, Commissioner Johnson. You mentioned green belts and black belts. And for those of you who are not in IT and don't know what that means, they are literally sort of the ninjas of the business process world. They are the folks who dig in really deep and figure out how to find those efficiencies and how to improve our process to do better. So I'm really glad that we are moving that direction. And I just wanted to briefly say thank you to Commissioner Johnson for all of this work and say that what we have before us, and I know this is hard for our members who are not IT related, but I know we talked about with Representative Grunhagen, not necessarily knowing how IT and government fit together, but here's the incredible part. IT has an incredible role to play here in being able to make things more transparent, to make them more efficient, and to provide better outcomes for our citizens and really focus in on what our citizens actually need and want. And as a person who works in Agile, I can tell you that those smaller iterations help avoid situations like we saw with the Minlars situation, and really help focus in on how we do that in a really smart, targeted way and get constant feedback from the users to understand how we're actually serving the best interests of our customers, which are of course the citizens of Minnesota and the folks at our agencies. So just wanna be clear about that. And in terms of the electronic medical records, I wanna thank you for that. There are so many opportunities where we are potentially failing or not giving the best care because we don't have the ability to have electronic medical records. They are so vitally important to deliver the best care possible to our citizens. And so this is a project that I think is really worthy and really noteworthy, and I just wanted to underscore both of those items for us. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Representative Damon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question, if I could direct to Inspector General Moti. And sure. My question is related to the emergency background study credit on page 12. Can you explain that a little bit more? On the slide, it talks about following the resubmission of studies. Is this duplicative? Does this catch us up for background studies? Can you just explain a little bit more on this particular area?
Thank you, Ms. Moti.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Damas. Yes, this is the allocation that we had for last year, which you all had authorized and put in, had anticipated us being in emergency studies through July. And so we had a lot of work that we needed to do on that, and we didn't start our transition to September. So we were in emergency studies and more people were paying that $20 fee for longer than anticipated. And then we did a phased in approach. And so others, again, were in emergency studies for a little bit longer time period than what we had initially budgeted last year. And so this is to account for those costs and so that we're able to provide those credits and that we have enough funding to be able to do that for those people who paid for an emergency study after July 1st.
So Ms. Moti, this is so we don't double charge the user. Is that kind of it?
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, it's for that.
Representative Damoth, does that help?
That does help. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. All right, let's move on then. And we have Assistant Commissioner Matemba Mutasa. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gertrude Matemba Mutasa. I currently serve as Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Human Services. The current state of the opioid crisis in Minnesota is alarming, and the trend is escalating as we've seen a 56% increase in deaths between 2019 and 2020 alone. Additionally, this crisis has drastic and increasing disproportionate impacts across the states, particularly in communities of color. This proposal is in two parts. Then the first part is dedicated to making sure that resources go to those communities that have been disproportionately impacted. It also adds members from each of the federally recognized tribes, of which there are 11. Currently, there are two tribal members representative on the council. The proposal requires 40% of ORAC, which is the Opioid Council grants, to be spent on culturally responsive proposals and adds base funding to continue traditional healing grants, which are set to expire before 2025. The second part of the proposal is to establish a framework to measure outcomes and improvements over time so that the Opioid Council and the state can have an eye on local impacts and be aware of new and promising practices that may warrant ongoing investments and statewide implementation. I'll hand it over to the next presenter.
All right, thank you very much. And then we have Cynthia McDonald, Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare. Welcome to the committee. Is Ms. McDonald here?
Yes, I am here, and I was wondering if you can hear me.
Now we can, wonderful. Yes, thank you.
You can, lovely, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cynthia McDonald, and I serve as the Assistant Commissioner at DHS for the Healthcare Administration and also am the State Medicaid Director. And I'm very pleased today is my first appearance before you today in this role. So I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to be with you this afternoon and to share our portion of the governor's priorities for healthcare in this year's supplemental budget. I've got six proposals to walk through, so I'll try to get through them pretty quickly. I'll start with the highlight of the first one. So there we go. Continuous Medicaid eligibility for children under age 21. So the governor is recommending changing medical assistance eligibility for children under age 21 to give them 12 months of continuous eligibility coverage. This change is expected to result in an average of an additional 15,888 children a month retaining their medical assistance coverage. Continuous eligibility means that a child determined eligible for medical assistance remains eligible until the annual renewal, regardless of most changes in circumstances, such as income increases, that would ordinarily cause the child to lose eligibility during the year. 23 states have implemented already a 12-month continuous eligibility for children in Medicaid as of January and 25 for Minnesota Care. I'll move on to item two, proposal two. This is medical assistance for former foster youth. And this proposal amends state law to comply with the Federal Support Act requirements regarding medical assistance for former foster care youth. Effective January 1st, 2023, a person who was formerly in foster care on their 18th birthday and receiving Medicaid in any state when their foster care ended will qualify for medical assistance as a former foster care youth in Minnesota until age 26. I'll move on to proposal three, coverage for undocumented children. The governor recommends expanding the Minnesota Care program to provide coverage to undocumented children under the age of 19. This state-only funded Minnesota Care expansion is estimated to provide healthcare access for around 1,700 children living in Minnesota once it's fully implemented in January of 2024. Next one is enhancing the COVID-19 vaccination rates in Minnesota healthcare programs. And the governor recommends funding for community outreach grants to supported trusted messenger programs. Those are programs in the community that are trusted by that community, and also culturally informed community-based providers to encourage vaccination against COVID-19 and other communicable diseases. This would include a variety of outreach methods to encourage vaccination, answer questions, and address this information and provide information. These grants would be made available statewide, and organizations from and who work with communities that have the largest disparities in vaccination rates will be prioritized. Moving on to the next proposal, removing the doula supervision requirement. The governor recommends removing the requirement that doulas be supervised by a licensed provider to be eligible for payment under the medical assistance program. And removing this requirement will expand access to doula care, which is linked to both better maternal and postpartum outcomes, both for physical health and emotional health and support. As a result of this change, doulas will now be able to directly enroll providers in medical assistance and be able to receive direct payment from the state. And the next proposal is entitled Improving Healthcare Access and Affordability. The governor is recommending taking what I call a three-prong approach to reducing the number of Minnesotans who are uninsured and improving affordability of healthcare for Minnesotans who are struggling to pay for the insurance that they have. First, the first prong of the proposal is will reduce barriers to already existing coverage options by improving the experience of people on the program already or seeking to apply for public healthcare programs. And those are really around operational investments to help enhance the systems and the means, again, to access into the program. The second prong of this proposal expands coverage options by modifying existing medical assistance and Minnesota Care programs and creating a product that Minnesotans can purchase to help address the affordability of their healthcare. It establishes a Minnesota Care buy-in that permits individuals with incomes over 200% of the federal poverty limit to purchase Minnesota Care. And that 200%, just to give you a perspective, for a single adult, that's about almost $26,000. For a family of four, that's about $53,000. So those people at that 200% of poverty will be able to buy into Minnesota Care. And then DHS will develop a sliding premium scale for that premium, pardon me. And then the third prong of this proposal invests in system infrastructure and existing enrollment processes to improve the enrollee experience for public programs, and then streamline the consumer experience across public programs and into the individual marketplace. So DHS will collaborate with MNsure on the new IT components that include self-service support for other healthcare providers and other ways to streamline kind of that one-door approach that we work with on MNsure each day. That is a very quick run-through of six important proposals. Thank you for the opportunity to share. And I'll just note, as I started, the governor's budget for healthcare prioritizes two things. It prioritizes removing barriers for coverage for which Minnesotans are already eligible. And then secondly, it expands coverage options to allow more people access to comprehensive healthcare coverage.
All right. Thank you, Ms. McDonald. I see our representative Grunhagen has his hand up, but we do have a few minutes for questions. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, my question is for Ms. McDonald. So the Minnesota Care is 150% right now, correct?
Ms. McDonald. I believe it is 106. Sorry, Madam Chair.
I think it's 138% of poverty. Is that what you're referring to, Representative Grunhagen? Like what the income level is right now?
It's currently 200%. It's at that 200%. So people above 200% are not currently cannot buy into Minnesota Care. There are premiums. So for instance, if you're at 160% of federal poverty, I believe that I would have DHS people help me with that, but I think it's at 160%. There is no premium under that amount.
So what change are we making if it's 200% already? What I missed that for some. I didn't pick that up in your presentation.
Yes. Ms. McDonald.
So, yes, thank you. The The change is that now, for now, it's the program is basically in place for people up to 200% of poverty. This now will allow a buy-in for people above 200% of poverty, but at a sliding premium scale.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I do have an additional question. Then, see, the problem with Minnesota Care, it reimburses at approximately Medicaid.
Representative Gruenhagen, do you have a question, or are you just going to make the statement that we've heard before?
Well, repetition is the key to learning. But no, my question is there a cap on, can everybody buy into it regardless of income now on a sliding scale of premium? So basically we're expanding Minnesota Care for everyone in the state, or is there a cap on the income at all?
Ms. McDonald.
Yes, Chair Liebling and Representative Gruenhagen. It is, there is no cap. So it does allow into the program above 200%.
Okay, Madam Chair, just a quick comment. So basically, we're doing a public option is what it amounts to.
Well, I think that's right, Representative Gruenhagen. It's a public option.
I have to say we better vote against it unless we want to destroy our healthcare system with the reimbursement rate.
Okay, questions? Thank you. Are there other questions for either of our last two presenters or any of our presenters at this point? Okay, not seeing any. So thank you very much. For the last two presenters and for all of the presenters from DHS. We will move on then to Minture. And I believe that Nate Clark is with us. Mr. Clark.
Let me just make sure my video is working and then I'll be right with you.
Well, excellent. We see you and we see your slides.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon to you and members of the committee. My name is Nate Clark, and I serve as the CEO of Minsure. Today, I'll be discussing one item in the governor's supplemental budget, and then we prepared a few slides to go along with my remarks. The governor recommends upgrading and replacing the core technology that supports Minsure, the state's health insurance marketplace. This proposal improves the experience for Minnesotans who use the technology to apply, shop for, enroll, and maintain their enrollment in a qualified health plan, or a QHP as we refer to it. The proposal also improves the systems and tools that caseworkers use to manage enrollee information. Before I get into details of the proposal, I'll start with some quick background for the committee. Minsure was established in 2013 to ensure all Minnesotans have the security of healthcare. Our goal has been to promote consumer choice, reduce health disparities, simplify the process of enrolling in a QHP, and facilitate transitions in coverage for those Minnesotans who move between a QHP and state health care program. Minsure is a one-stop shop for private health insurance and public programs. Minnesotans looking to access a private plan on the individual market or Minnesota Care or Minnesota or medical assistance can visit Minsure.org, fill out an online application that determines their eligibility for these coverage options. The application and eligibility technology platform used by Minsure was launched in 2013 and is shared by our partners at the Department of Human Services, counties and tribes. It's referred to as the Minnesota Eligibility Technology System or METS. And since our launch in 2013, Minsure has worked with our agency partners to upgrade the platform and improve service delivery for Minnesotans. Minsure has also made strategic investments that improve the consumer experience for Minnesotans who apply specifically for qualified health plans. And this work has paid dividends. For several years now, we've seen record-breaking signups with hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans coming to Minsure to enroll in comprehensive health coverage and access to federal tax credits that reduce the cost of their monthly premiums. Our recent efforts include a 2019 project to replace the legacy plan shopping and enrollment technology system, in addition to simplifying and streamlining the plan comparison, shopping, and enrollment process. The new technology enabled Minsure to better manage and report consumer enrollment information and to interface with insurance carriers and federal systems. As a result of the investment, we've seen substantial improvements to Minsure operations and significant service improvements for our customers. The value of the 2019 technology investment became more evident when Minsure was able to leverage that technology to rapidly implement program changes that were mandated by the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, ensuring that Minnesotans could access the enhanced tax credits available as quickly as possible. However, structural limitations in the underlying application and customer management technology continue to hamper our efforts to further improve service delivery and to reach more uninsured and underinsured Minnesotans. Minsure has responded to these limitations with manual work processes and higher staffing levels and through frequent costly updates to the IT platform. These improvements are incremental, however, and don't address the constraints that prevent us from offering Minnesotans the service experience they want and need. The governor's recommendation recognizes that upgrading the legacy IT platform is necessary to providing a streamlined, simple, and more efficient application and enrollment experience that's easy to use and removes barriers that make it difficult for Minnesotans to access and maintain health insurance coverage. As a result of the proposal, Minsure will be able to reach more Minnesotans who reach the Minnesotans who need us most, referring to those who continue to remain uninsured or underinsured. It will improve service delivery and create better consumer experience, become a more agile and efficient agency, and also enable us to establish a solid technological foundation that will bring us into the future. What exactly does the proposal deliver? It preserves the no wrong door approach to applying for health coverage, so Minnesotans will continue to come to Minsure to access health coverage as they do today. It introduces consumer self-service capabilities so that consumers can quickly and easily access their account information and report updates without having to call the Minsure Contact Center. It improves access for limited English proficient Minnesotans by providing an application and enrollment experience in multiple languages, including printed notices and consumer notifications. It introduces a new assister portal that improves services capabilities for navigators and brokers who help Minnesotans apply and enroll in coverage through Minsure. It upgrades the systems that caseworkers use to access, maintain, and update consumer accounts. The updated platform will have lower maintenance and operations costs, will be easier and less expensive to modify and upgrade, and will have the flexibility to support future federal and state healthcare regulatory changes and policy innovation. And finally, it will generate more sustainable operations for Minsure, including permanent annual projected savings to Minsure's budget of over $4 million beginning in fiscal 25 and reductions of thousands of hours in staff and consumer time that's currently spent on manual processes and calls to the Minsure Contact Center. This final slide presents a summary of the fiscal impact of the proposal. Costs for the proposal include minute costs to decommission QHP programs from the legacy system, licensing replacement application, eligibility, assister, and other technology from an outside vendor, and 1 year of maintenance and operations costs as we transition to a fully operational system. The amount the governor is recommending in the supplemental budget comes to about $18.8 million over 3 years. One final thing I'll note is that we have been hearing from and engaging with stakeholders for quite some time on many of the issues this proposal is designed to address. This proposal will greatly improve the experience for the Minnesotans that we serve, and we're pleased to be able to continue to work with our stakeholder partners in the coming months, many of whom we know are looking forward to the upgrades and features a modern IT platform can provide. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair. We look forward to answering any questions you have today and to working with you as the session moves forward.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Clark. Are there any questions from members on Mr. Clark's presentation? Okay. And I would just ask a quick one, Mr. Clark, not so much about what you presented, but you kind of mentioned really quickly what happened under the American Rescue Plan with the special provisions to deal mm-hmm. with high insurance premiums. And I wonder if you could just lay that out a little bit more clearly here for folks that may not be aware of that, because after all, there aren't that mm-hmm. many people in the individual market in Minnesota compared to the whole population. So yeah. Everyone might not be aware of this, but it certainly would have been significant for people who took advantage of it. Could you just tell us a little more specifically what that was?
Yeah, absolutely. So the American Rescue Plan Act included some provisions that expanded access to APTC, or premium tax credits. It expanded access to those credits to some Minnesotans who previously were ineligible, and then those who were already receiving them, it actually increased the amount of assistance they were receiving. And we had some special enrollment periods last year, and the result of those special enrollment periods were that we saw a significant uptake of new enrollments, and then also folks benefiting from increased savings. There was a third component, and that was that individuals would receive 1 month of unemployment insurance during the 2021 were able to actually receive free or greatly reduced insurance as well. And so those were the benefits of the American Rescue Plan Act. The great thing for us is that that act is still in effect. And so all those provisions, apart from the unemployment insurance provision, are in effect for plan year 2022. And we saw the real positive impact of the ARP provisions simply because we had a record number of Minnesotans who renewed into coverage for plan year 2022. And then we had a significant increase in the number of enrollees as well. So we actually ended our enrollment period with a total of 134,000 Minnesotans who signed up for coverage and who are receiving benefits much higher than they would have been able to receive without the American Rescue Plan. I apologize if I went on too long, because I could go on all day. This is a great topic.
Yeah, thank you. No, thank you for pointing that out. So just, you know, we've had a lot of discussion in the legislature in the past about the high cost of insurance and the high cost of premiums, and how even with plans on Venture that some people who had higher incomes and had to pay the full freight could not afford to buy a plan. And then, of course, even when they had one, they had really high out-of-pocket. So the American Rescue Plan came in and said, we're going to cap your premiums for a period of time. And my understanding is that cap on premiums would continue under the Build Back Better plan if we could get bipartisan buy-in to pass that in Congress. So, but anyway, we'll move on, because we do have one other presenter. And thank you very much, Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So now we have a presentation from the Minnesota Department of Health on the family home visiting update. And this is a significant issue for us, and one that I think will be occupying some of our time this session. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, and please just go ahead and introduce yourself.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dawn Reckinger, and I'm the manager of home visiting at the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm going to share my screen. All right. So you can see the slides now?
Yes, we can.
All right, great. Thank you. So let me move forward. So I have sort of three things that I'm going to share with the committee today. First, I'm going to describe, for those who might not be familiar, what is home visiting. We'll talk a little bit about the current program, particularly some of the sort of status with COVID and how many families we're serving. And then we'll also go into the governor's proposal. So I have about 8 slides. Let's get to my screen here. So for those of you who might not be familiar with home visiting is a voluntary service that we provide to pregnant women, parenting families who are most in need of support. What happens is a trained home visitor goes into the home or wherever that family decides is the best place for them to meet. It could be a park, it could be grandma's house. They conduct their home visiting. Ideally, we begin prenatally with the family. A lot of families re-enroll at birth or shortly after birth. And then we usually continue through the early years of that child's life. Home visiting focuses on several parts of assisting that family to raise that child in the best environment that they can. That involves connecting families to community services, supporting parents early in their role as child's first teacher, helping parents develop safe, stable, and nurturing environments that support healthy development, and fostering parent skills that decrease the risk of child abuse. So how does it work? The majority of current home programs are what we call long-term, where they're staying with the family for anywhere from 2 to 3 years. Again, we hope that they start prenatally or definitely shortly after birth. Visits are often closer together, shortly during the prenatal period and when that baby first comes home, when the parents often are overwhelmed and kind of need the most help. And then they sort of space out as the parents and caregivers become more adept, get connected to more resources, so that, and also sort of build their confidence that, that they really can do this. Again, programs usually go for 2 to 3 years. So around the time the child is 2 to 3 years old, ideally they've connected them to the next step. For some families, that might be early Head Start or their ECFP programs or whatever that family needed. And so the home visiting ends at that time. Here's sort of what a typical visit, some of the topics it might cover. They would definitely go over the stages of development of the child, discuss that with the parent or caregiver. They may involve doing an activity to help the parent learn how they can help nurture and support both the social, emotional, and physical development milestones of the child. We talk about the importance of safety and health information, also for the child, but the mom, the dad, any older children that might be in the family. Topics that they go over would be shaken baby syndrome, oral health. Postpartum depression is a very one that we cover a lot. Healthy nutrition and physical activity. Again, not only for baby, but for the mom and dad and caregivers in general. Screenings for social development progress, making sure that baby is on track, making sure that they have their immunizations. Again, screening for maternal depression, family violence. And then depending on how those screenings turn out, making a plan, again, always voluntarily with the family about what they want to pursue, getting them connected to referrals, helping them make those calls if that's what's needed. And then a lot of home visiting also focuses on mom and dad working on goals and skill building, not just for them, their parenting, but for themselves. This can include problem solving, learning how to navigate other support systems in the community, practicing parenting skills and communication. So just a little bit of overview of 2021. So we saw actually, I'm going to go to the sort of larger third point down there. Normally we see about 12,000 families a year in the state of Minnesota. I think you can definitely see the impacts of COVID. Our numbers were down significantly to 7,266 pregnant women and caregivers were seeing. We know that the need has not gone down. In fact, if anything, the need has probably increased across the state, given the challenges of COVID and unemployment and many stressors that families are facing. As you can see the map on the left side, we track which counties and tribal nations are implementing what we call an evidence-based home visiting model. Most of the models have 10, 20, 30 years of research behind them that show that if you do this in this order, you know, and help the family in this way, you'll get these good outcomes. So we are very interested in promoting those evidence-based models. And so we do sort of this one color map. And over the last, this has been an ongoing project for probably about 10, 12 years. So we now have 85 counties, 8 tribes, and 19 nonprofits that implement an evidence-based home visiting model that is at least in some part funded by MDH. This map does not include the early Head Start that the federal government and MDE oversees, so just to clarify that. I'll talk briefly about the impact of COVID. So we know that the pandemic has disproportionately had a negative impact on the communities that family home visiting seeks to serve. The health, economic, social, and psychological burdens have been exacerbated in the communities that we were already unevenly impacted by structural and racial inequities. COVID-19 has also had a crippling effect on all of our family home visiting programs and agencies at the local level. Directly and indirectly impacting staff, planning, recruitment, and implementation. For most of our counties, they employ public health nurses who have been the backbone of doing vaccines this year. So they have been on a yo-yo of where they'll, you know, go to vaccine clinics, then they'll get busy, go back to their home visiting for a little bit, and then do other vaccine clinics as more have opened up. So it is, they have been troopers and as always the backbone of our public health system here, but it has been very challenging for them. And the same has happened for our nonprofits and tribes who don't tend to employ nurses as much, but their families and communities have been deeply hit. Many families, they serve some of our most vulnerable families who might have English as a second language, less access to resources, and so recruiting them and finding safe ways to do home visiting has been challenging. As always, our home visiting workforce is very resilient and creative, so we have seen an increase in virtual home visits, dropping off of materials, increase in texting and trying to engage with families in between the visits, doing outside visits when the weather was allowing it, and then, of course, when feasible, doing in-person visits as long as safety could be maintained. I'll just review a little bit about our current funding. So currently we oversee $36 million in stable federal and state funding. That includes $8.5 million in TANF allocations to use for home visiting. They can also use it for WIC nutrition or pregnancy prevention, but at a minimum of 50% of the money must be used for home visiting. That goes to our counties and tribes. We receive approximately $9 million in what we call MICVE, which is the Maternal Infant Early Childhood Home Visiting Program. It's the federal funding for evidence-based home visiting. And the state in 2015 allocated $2 million specifically to the Nurse Family Partnership Model Program. And then we have the relatively newer state funding that is $16.5 million in ongoing per year. And in the base, what these numbers don't include is the federal MICVE program has released an additional two pots of money out of ARP. So Minnesota is getting about $3 million in sort of a temporary period through 2024. And then the state also passed an additional $1.5 million for the next 3 years. So those last two parts are not included on the slide. And then the last bullet point is that the majority of this funding is required to go to what we call, again, evidence-based home visiting programs, those programs that have 20, 30 years of research that have been done on multiple different types of families and ages and race and ethnicity. And again, it sort of you know, helps us know that if we do this, you know, with this amount of dosage, with the families covering these topics, these families and these children will show good outcomes. So I'll go over briefly the governor's home visiting proposal. In sort of a nutshell, basically it is aimed at addressing current gaps in services by expanding services to more families and creating greater flexibility to serve Minnesota's highest priority populations. There's really sort of three components. One is to create and fund a universal short-term home visiting program. And by short-term, we mean approximately 1 to 3 visits. The numbers we were using is that there's approximately 69,000 births each year in Minnesota. The goal of this program as it scales up would be to serve all of those children and the families that they come into with at least one, potentially 3 visits to get them connected to resources, to make sure they have their basic questions, to do any screening, you know, that might be appropriate. Many of those families would be referred on to our other next tiers that you're going to see here. The second one is really to create and fund what we're referring to as evidence-informed home visiting programs to serve priority populations. Our evidence-based models, our long-term models that we have now are wonderful and they have amazing outcomes, but they don't fit every family. We know that, and the researchers know that if you can recruit a family early on, ideally before birth or certainly shortly after, you can have the most dramatic impact on that child. What we know is that families don't always find their way into our system, you know, at those times. So this evidence-informed is really going to serve priority populations like families who are experiencing incarceration, families who experience homelessness, children and youth with special health needs, a variety of other sort of priority populations that, again, wouldn't sort of lend themselves to these, to fitting into these evidence-based models, and that we as Minnesota could still serve these families in more of an adapted approach that would recognize the particular needs they have, whether that be racial, ethnic, cultural, the issues that families are need help with. So we're calling that sort of our mid-range and more flexible home visiting. And then the third part would be to expand, again, that long-term evidence-based home visiting program across Minnesota. And that we feel is strongly needed. One, because we're only serving about 10% of the eligible families with a long-term evidence base. And two, once you create a universal home visiting program where you're seeing the need, this would allow us to respond to some of those greater needs that families, so that when they were identified, we can say, and you have an option to go to this long-term evidence-based program. And I have my last slide. Here are the costs. So the program will be scaled up over 3 years. The costs are on the left. So in years 1, 2, 3, it's, you know, approximately 126 million, then 210 million, 313 million. And then on the right-hand side, you can see the number of families that we'd be serving. Of course, the majority of those families are through the short-term home visiting, but it would again scale up so that when it was a stable program, it would be approximately 313 million a year, serving 103,000 families over there. Not over 90% of these requested funds would go be distributed directly to community health boards, tribal nations, or nonprofits via grants for the delivery of home visiting services. The overhead admin costs are 9.1%. And we anticipate that home visiting providers will be a mixture of nurses, professionals with, you know, child development or other related backgrounds, pregnancy and other expertise, and of course, paraprofessionals. I'm pretty sure that is, yeah, my last slide.
All right, well, thank you very much, Ms. Reckinger, right? Is that right, Reckinger?
Yeah.
Okay, we appreciate this. And so members, you can see that this is a significant proposal. Family home visiting has been around a long time, and it is one of the best proven approaches to good outcomes for kids and families. And so this is a great thing to put some resources into and expand if we're able. So thank you so much for your presentation. Are there any questions for members? We do have some time, so. All right, Representative Bonner.
Maybe just a really quick comment. I know that was a lot of information in a very short amount of time. I will tell you, I know Representative Morrison represents part of this population. I represent a part of this as well in home visiting. And, you know, if we boil it all down, this is really the gist. It works. We know it works. We know the outcomes that it has for our kiddos are incredible. We also know that for our folks, when we talk about being responsible and thinking about our return on investment, not only are kiddos, I would argue, our best return on investment, period, but when we talk about the finances, the reality is getting kids off to a good start, making sure they have those better outcomes, it literally saves us money down the road. It pays off dividends in the outcomes for these kids, their chances for the future to feed into being those citizens of the next generation. And so it is such incredible work, and it always floors me that we don't spend more because of that incredible return on investment, that we don't do a better job of really putting our money where it can be used most strategically, and really doing right by our future generations. So thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Bonner. I so agree with you. And, you know, in a perfect world, maybe every family would have a relative who would be like the wise grandmother who would be able to mentor the new parents and all of that stuff. And many families just don't have that. And this is a kind of mentorship that gets people off to the right, off on the right foot during that very critical early time. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, my question, in terms of these families that are, do they contact you to be enrolled? Do you, or does your agency or whatever contact them? Or how do we know which families want these services? Or what's the criteria, I guess? Because it looks like you're projecting an increase, you know, substantial increase. And I just want to know, how do they call in, contact you, or do you contact them based on some criteria? I hope I made that question clear.
Great question, Representative Grunhagen. Ms. Reckinger.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Grunhagen, not sure if I'm saying your name right. So we do not in Minnesota as yet have a centralized intake system. So what happens is that the intake usually happens at the local county level, or for our nonprofits and tribes at their level. So the referral system in home visiting is pretty in-depth and critical. So if you're a home visiting agency, you are connecting with all of the primary care providers in your area. You're connecting with the schools, with the food shelves, with other systems, you know, certainly WIC, letting them know about your program. And most of the what happens is it's referrals. So my husband is a family health practice doctor. If he knows, he gets a client in and sees that someone needs that, he might call. We live in Anoka County, so he would call Anoka County Public Health and say, after he said to the family, would you like this? I've heard about this great service. And the family says, yes, I'd like to hear about it. So then the public health nurse or the nonprofit agency would reach out. Some of you may be aware of our the Help Me Connect program, where we're trying to build a system where families or providers could go into an online system and learn about not only home visiting, but all the other referrals that are services that are eligible. So a family could go in and look that way, or a provider could as well. And then of course they work with hospitals, so they know the births that are happening. So it's always offered to the family.
Thank you. Representative Keel.
Oh, Madam Chair, I had one.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Grunhagen, you have a follow-up to that?
Just the, so if a family in being contacted says, no, I don't want those services, even if they're explained, they're not mandated to take them, correct?
Ms. Reckinger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Absolutely correct. This is a voluntary service in all of our grant agreements. They have voluntary written into their contracts, and I think a home visitor would be appalled to try and force someone to do home visiting that they didn't want to. So it is always voluntary.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder, we just heard that the governor's proposal was to, I believe, encourage doulas. And so I'm thinking that both of these programs are similar. Doulas are a fairly new concept, would we be doubling up on those types of services? I'm guessing that doulas often are available at early pregnancy appointments, and of course some people by way of communication with others, but doulas often are involved, and you know, if you have more than one child, your two-year-old is maybe, you know, getting to 3 years old, and there's another child, so that service would be connected. So I guess what I'm asking is, is that an overlap of services or are they two choices? And I realize one is just, well, the doulas exist, but governor's suggesting that we expand that program, I believe is what I understood.
Ms. Reckinger, I don't know if you can answer that because I know the doula proposal's in Department of Human Services. So, I don't know if you're familiar enough that you could answer that if there's overlap.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Keel. I am not an expert on doulas, but I can speak to some of it. And so home visiting really is, for the most part, so there's the universal, there's the mid-range and the long-term. But it does involve that the baby is there. So while we do try and start prenatally, the real focus is once that baby is born and getting that family connected to services. So while I think there is an intersect, just like there is with their primary care provider and doulas, I think they are distinct. We would describe them as very distinct services.
Yeah, thank you for that. And it's a great question, Representative Keel, and we could ask DHS to follow up on that to see, you're correct. There is a proposal to expand doulas, and I think it would be certainly worth understanding what the overlap is. So thank you. We'll ask DHS to follow up on that.
Okay.
Representative Bonner?
I just wanted to kind of step in and volunteer that, there is a tiny bit of overlap there, Representative Keel, but for the most part, a lot of what's happening with family home visiting actually, again, does happen after kiddos are actually here and working with the family and the individual kiddos, whereas the doulas tend to be a little bit more focused on prenatal care and sort of getting moms taken care of and things like that. So there are a few places where they could overlap, but for the most part, they're kind of different spheres.
Representative Keel?
That helps.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'm aware of them. I even think about my 43-year-old when she was born. Public health did come into my house. She was my firstborn. And of course, I had the blessing of both my mother and my mother-in-law around. So I had a lot of extra help. And of course, you didn't see them with the following children. But I had that support system. So I'm assuming that it was probably pretty small at that point. That's a lot of years ago. But with doulas, my experience with that is my own daughters who live down in Mankato, so they're far away from me, have doulas that are around for delivery. Sometimes they've done it in the hospital and sometimes they've done it when they've had home births now. And the doulas end up being friends, so they're around for longer than just the baby, just the delivery and that support system. But I would point out, maybe this is a question for Don, but how do we reach out to those who choose, because there's a lot more midwives. Rural Minnesota has got a lot of people that choose to have babies at home. So is that service, those babies are reported, I realize that, but is there a service, or do you get connected with that, and can you at that point reach out to those families?
Ms. Reckinger?
Sure, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Keel. Yes, so that's where I talk about that referral system, both in and out, is so critical. So we tell agencies, they may have a favorite referral system that may be the hospital, it may be WIC. All of those are necessary, but they're not sufficient. When we really want to get all families, we need to be, again, in the schools, in the food shelves, in the alternative learning centers, finding sometimes churches, mosques, synagogues. It's really being in that community to get those referrals. So while certainly birth records are sort of the stopgap of like, okay, I know this child is now exists, when we want to get in before they're really trying to be comprehensive in their community.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Representative Keel. I think those of us who have kids and grandkids are probably, it's easy to imagine how helpful this is, right? If you as we always say, kids don't come with instruction manuals. And when you're having one for the first time, it can be a pretty overwhelming experience. And I often do think about those families where they don't have, you know, they don't come from support and they don't have anybody near them, or maybe their own parent wasn't a good parent, or maybe they grew up in foster care. And there are just a lot of situations where helping at the beginning of a child's life can be just exceptionally important. So and the evidence is certainly there that it does make a difference. Okay, well, thank you very much for that presentation. I'm sure we will have more discussion about that in coming weeks. And so I would just say, members, that brings us to the end of our presentations for today. We have tomorrow, we will hear from Department of Health and the Department of Human Services about the healthcare workforce, which I think is a topic that is of deep concern to everyone. And we're also going to hear a report on a new study on building racial equity into the walls of Minnesota Medicaid. So that is, I'm really looking forward to hearing more about that. So with that, members, I don't think we have any further business for today. Oh, I see Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've been noticing with several members, including the chair, of where there's freezing. And I'm thinking that if you run into that, maybe turning off the video might alleviate that, because just a comment and inquiry. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Quam. And when you first said that, I thought you meant like literally freezing, because I am cold and I've been here sitting here wrapped in my little blanket. But if members' frames are freezing and you notice it, you might want to turn off your video. All right. Thank you, everyone. We are adjourned.